Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, and welcome back to We're Not So Different, a podcast about how we've always been idiots. My name is Luke. I'm an amateur historian, and as always, I am joined by Dr. Eleanor Yanega, who is anything but. Today, we are talking about medieval systems of measurement. But before we do, we have a question from our patron, Laura, who asks, Eleanor, how would you have ended Game of Thrones?
Oh, that's damn, Laura. So I guess that my first thing is that I think it should have all taken longer. Like, I don't mind where they got up to if what we're talking about is, like, Dany going nuts and torturing everything. I think that was kind of inevitable and it made some sense. Like, that's fine. There's certain things that I would have got rid of that really annoy me, which is, like, the killing of so many of dragon. Because, I mean, like, I can maybe give you the one dragon north of the wall, maybe.
Yeah.
But it doesn't make any sense that, like, they make a dragon killing instrument and then, easily kill one dragon and then, like, it never is a problem again. I don't accept that, and I get mad about dragon killing, so that's fine. I'm also kind of mad about the dragon north of the wall, though, because the way that I feel about the whole thing is that, so what was the plan that the White Walkers had if they didn't get a hold of a dragon to bring down the wall? Like, what was the fucking plan? Right? Yeah. And I feel like using I need some other, like, it's just too much of a deus ex machina, right? It's just, like, too much, like, oh, there you go. Like, everyone through the plot hole and on the other side of the wall, right? Like, there needed to be something else. So I would have come up with another way of doing that. Don't mind the battle for Winterfell. I'll take it. Don't mind Dany going nuts. I'll take it. But it's just, I wanted to see it build up in that slow way that they ordinarily did. And then I guess I do like Jon then kind of like going back north of the wall. I think that's fine and good. But I have this weird thing about, you know, like how the Starks end up in charge of everything. Like, it's weird that there's all this kind of, like, you know, Seven Kingdoms stuff and whatever and what have you. And then at the end, they're like, oh, we're just going to let the North go. Like, that's fine. Like, seems odd. But I suppose it would have been nice, I think, to see maybe, you know, and I see the point of, like, it's you're going to be difficult to, like, turn everything into a democracy, and I'm not asking for things to turn into a democracy at the end. But what I would have liked, I suppose, is to see something that's a little bit more like, for example, I think they could have set up, like, an electoral system like the Holy Roman Empire, and that would have been cute. Like, saying that everyone votes on who the king is. So it's like, so all of the kingdoms get together and they have a vote. And I think that would have been a nice way of doing it. And then I guess you can go ahead and put Bran on there or whatever. But I want, like, more, I want something more systemic than, like, you know, a random Tyrion speech, right?
Yeah.
That's kind of where I'm coming from with it. So I got a lot of fucking problems with you people. That's my point. And it's like, it's not necessarily where they end up. It's how they get there that annoys me.
Yeah.
What about you?
I think one of the funny things I do think about the ending of Game of Thrones is that the place that they get to is, in the end, is pretty much what people think they're going to end up getting to in the books. Danny is going to go nuts, or, you know, feel justified in committing some insane atrocities for some reason. John will end up killing her because of this. He will be exiled north of the wall. Bran will be the king. Mm-hmm. Most of this stuff is like stuff that people expect. Like people who read the book, who like go really in depth on the books, they expect that to happen. The thing is how you get there. Like how do you get from point here to point there? And a thing that I have said about the show for a long time is that when they dropped the young Griff storyline, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, and the Euron starting the Eldritch Apocalypse storyline, mm-hmm, that basically like fucked up how they were going to be able to tell the end, because what people kind of think is going to happen. So there's the, in the books, there's this guy called Young Griff, and he supposedly,
I love the Young Griff storyline.
Yeah. He's supposedly Aegon Targaryen, who wasn't actually killed, on the night that King's Landing was sacked and the Targaryens were overthrown. But in reality, he's probably a Blackfyre, which are former pretenders to the throne, who's going to come in. And in the books, that is who Dany is going to face off with in the South. So it's not going to be this like weird storyline where Cersei gets her thing just extended out and extended out and extended out. And I understand people love Cersei, and I do too. And Lena Headey is great in the show.
Yeah.
But that storyline has like a finite length that it can go, where she can like play the big bad, because that's not her character. Like her character is to be like a basket case who is, you know, a drunkard and has incredible horrific mood swings and you know, leads to murderous and awful shit. But like, you can only take that so far. So when you take that out, you have to put Cersei in there. But the thing with Euron in the books is that he's not like a goofy pirate. Well, he is for a second, but then you pull back and you realize, especially in like sample chapters from the Winds of Winter that have been put out before, that basically Euron is like about to use crazy magic to take down, to like start attacking Westeros. He thinks he's going to become like this god of like, of the world and like rule over it, over all these like spirits and you know,
he's got that horn that fries your lungs and kills you if you blow
and so he's got that horn, which may bind dragons, so that's probably going to actually take care of one of the dragons of Danny's dragons, or at least turn it to the other side. But then on top of that, Sam is coming down, and he is in Old Town, and Sam is in possession of this horn that George R. R. Martin keeps pointing to and saying, hey, he has this horn. Maybe you should not forget that he has this very plain-looking Indiana Jones Holy Grail-ass horn.
Yeah.
When everybody else is like, oh, the Horn of Jorah, and it's going to be like this, you know, whatever. Mm. And it's just this little horn. And when Euron blows that, when all of this starts, that's going to take down part of the wall, which is going to allow the others through. So you don't have to have that weird ice dragon story up there. Though, I wouldn't be surprised if one of the dragons becomes an ice dragon at some point.
Yeah.
Like through whatever.
Yeah. Whatever the machinations of the horns are.
Ice zombie magic. Yeah. But, I mean, like it's that you have to, it's getting there. And so when you take out this stuff, you have to add, you have to like backfill everything else. And it just like, You have the famous saying by one of them. I can't remember if it's the Weiss and Benioff. I think it's Benioff who's like, well, you know, Danny sort of forgot about the Greyjoy fleet or something like yeah. that. And he's basically like, yeah, we just forgot about it. And it's like when you've got stuff like that, it's kind of hard to like, it's kind of hard for me to be like, oh yeah, the rest of this is going to be done well when you've got stuff like that. And you don't have George's like books to go on anymore. Game of Thrones ended underwhelmingly, but you know, overall, I think the beginning of it, at least the first like five seasons, and there's some stuff from the end too, but first five seasons are real good. Up to a point. So if you want to hear us talk more about Game of Thrones or House of the Dragon, then you should listen to or should subscribe to our Patreon for just $5 a month. You get to ask questions like Laura here did that we'll answer on the show. And you can listen to our two-part review of the House of the Dragon, season one. It's very good. We had a lot of fun with it. And there's also almost 30 other bonus episodes. All of these regular episodes are ad-free. And you can come and check it out and subscribe to the Discord or subscribe, get access to the Discord. And then when we get to 300 patrons, we're going to do a stream for our patrons of us talking all about Night's Tale. So that will be a lot of fun. Patreon.com/WNSDpod. And by the time you're hearing this, Eleanor and I will have already done an Elden Ring stream, because
that's right.
Right after we record this, it's just how the recording schedule is sometimes. But we have a YouTube channel where you can find these things. It's youtube.com/@ and then WNSDpod. You can find it there. You can find video on demand for the streams that we do over on Twitch. And yeah, you can. You can also see some old videos that I did when I was trying to do Let's Play stuff for Civ 6 a while back, and those are suitably weird, but I had fun doing them nonetheless. So check that out. Check out the stream. We have a lot of fun. It's good stuff. All right. So on to the main episode. A few months back, we had a question from our patron Rowan that asked us about medieval systems of counting and measurement. It was a good question, however. Being the thoughtless cur that I am, I was very late in getting the show notes to Eleanor and basically sprang a complicated question on her without really giving her enough time to prepare. At the time, Eleanor said she needed a bit more time to gather info on the subject, and well, here we are. More info has been gathered, and we're going to do a whole episode on medieval systems of measurement. So if you ever read the King James or New King James versions of the Bible and wondered what the fuck a cubit was or how many gallons were in a hogshead, now's your chance to find out. It's 79, by the way. 79 gallons in a hogshead. I looked it up. Maybe we'll answer questions like, were units like feet actually measurements of the current king foot size that changed with every new monarch, or did they have standard lengths? I'm assuming it was somehow standardized, but really, really hoping it's not, because that is, again, the much funnier outcome. We will also talk about how they delineated time and reckoned with the inexorable march of time as the months and years passed. And there's also how these newer medieval systems of measurement built on the older ones, because humans have been measuring the length, width, and breadth of things since just about the advent of writing, if not before that. We talked previously about one of my favorite bits of trivia, how our current base 60 numerical system used for degrees of motion, mathematical equations, and serves as basically the basis for all human timekeeping is, through many turns and peregrinations, based on how the Sumerians did rudimentary counting using their two hands. Each finger has three segments, and if you use your thumb to count each segment on all four fingers, that equals 12. Then if you keep count of the number of times you've gotten 12 on your other hand, you can go all the way up to 5. 5 times 12 equals 60. 60 minutes in an hour, 60 seconds in a day, or 60 seconds in a minute, et cetera, et cetera. The point is that people just like to measure things and have to some extent, like to measure things and to some extent, we've always been size queens. So join us as we talk through it. We promise that it's more fun than it might sound at first. Eleanor, let's start with measurements of time. How were these things reckoned?
Yeah, okay, so this is a really interesting one because, like, time in particular is a really slippery one in terms of what we talk about it, right? So we know, for example, that people have really good ways of kind of calculating time based on, you know, sundials, right? Mm-hmm. So sundials, really, really, really old, and you can do it just by sticking, you know, a stick in the ground. Just mm-hmm. like, bang, there you go. And we know that Egyptians have those things. But there's various kind of like other clocks and things that get developed over this, the kind of ancient period that are still in use in the medieval period. Mm-hmm. And we see them a lot of time, especially I picked three of my faves, which are in use in Al-Andalus and across like the Islamic world. And one of them is a sinking bowl. This is cute. So you get a bowl. It's kind of like a standardized thing for a bowl. And you punch a hole in it and you put it in water. And the time it takes to fill and sink to the bottom, that's, like, a unit of time.
Huh.
And
well,
like,
that's neat.
That's really neat, right? And, like, these we see often in play in order specifically to time things for irrigation. So, like, a big thing that will be in places where you need kind of water is that when you've got sort of irrigation that comes off a river and then goes into varying canals... the farmers whose canals, like the canals feed their fields, they all have to kind of take turns using that amount of water. Mm-hmm. And you've got like tons of water, like if the Nile's just flooded or something like that, then you don't need to worry about it because if you let too much water into your field, you're just going to kill everything. But at times when water is scarce, they'll then use things like sinking bowls in order to say, okay, you could have like your channel open for this long and then it needs to go to the next person and the next mm-hmm. person and the next person. There's also a big one that is in use in, like, North Africa, and it's called the Qad, which is Q-A-D, and that's kind of like a bucket, and then, like, you kind of, like, put an outflow on it, and then you wait for it to get filled up with water, you hang it up, and then you, like, you watch the water flow out. So kind of like the opposite of a sinking bowl. Right. Hmm. So they know that like this will empty in a particular amount of time. So like it takes however long for all the water to empty out of this thing.
Mm-hmm.
So water is like really, really common. And then a medieval invention is the sand clock. So, you know, like hourglasses and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so like we kind of like know about it from pictures from the 14th century. And then by the 15th century, it's super, super common and people talk about it all the time. And we know particularly that they get associated with mariners and astrologers and people like that who are keeping an eye on time. So there's all these kind of like ways of keeping an eye on time generally. But within that, it's kind of like, oh, we're just going to measure X unit of time. Like it's not necessarily about like minutes or seconds or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's wild to me, you know, that they didn't really calculate things in minutes or seconds. And I guess, you know, I guess that's a lot of that's because we didn't really have mechanical clock faces until like the 16th century. So it would be very difficult for like a, you know, for them to like set up something that was accurate enough to keep time to the 60th second and, you know, into the to the minute. Yeah,
and, like, in fact, like, their whole way of kind of looking at time is totally different. So, like, for medieval Europeans, and this is fun. I got way too into the, like, kind of time bit. So, you know, part of the way that they're just kind of thinking about it is that a day has two halves. You've got, like, the day, which is when it's light, mm-hmm. which is dies, and you've got the night, which is the dark time, which is nox, okay? Mm-hmm. And then both of those halves are subdivided into 12 hours. So it's still a 24-hour day, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But because they do it based on light, it means that the length of hours varies depending on what season you're in. So in the night, so in the winter, like here mm-hmm. I am in London, it's not 5 o'clock yet and it's completely dark. Hello, mm-hmm. November. So what happens like in places like this is that you end up having hours at night during winter being about twice as long as hours are in the day.
That's awesome.
Isn't that awesome? Like, I love this. And so it's really funny because, like, even when they do start having clocks in the later medieval period before, like, second hands and stuff were in there, oftentimes they are adjusted. So, like, you'll adjust them to be like, oh, no, we're on night hours now or whatever. So they don't attempt really to standardize these things at all. Even when they do have clocks, they're just like, yeah, word, because they just don't think about days like that, right?
Right.
And then sort of like the way that they then think about days is a lot more to do with what you call the hours of the divine office. And so this comes from the monks, and it's what we call orarium. And these, of course, are also going to vary from summer to winter. But so basically the way that they divide the day is you've got louds, which is dawn. You've got prime, which is daybreak. You've got terse, which is the morning. You've got sext, which is midday, nones, which is afternoon, vespers, which is evening, compline, which is nightfall, and matins, which is midnight. Okay. So, and you just sort of like think about the day more as being defined by these things. So then it's like there's this big gap, obviously, between matins and louds. So it's like midnight to dawn, right? But a fun fact about this is that the main meal was usually like kind of coming in around nones. And nones was initially around about 2, but people got hungry, so they moved it earlier. And so they're like, okay, well, fuck it, we're not going to standardize this, and they move it earlier, and then that's how we get the word noon from.
Yeah.
Right, so, this basically comes in play, like, from the beginning of the 5th century, and that's because that's when the rule of St. Benedict popularizes it. So basically, monks have to come up with it, and then people are kind of like, really, really, you know, into kind of being like monks because monks are holy. And so this becomes like this way of organizing the world. So it's like, yeah, those are called hours, right? But they're not hours. Yeah. But that is still kind of how they think about their days, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. Yeah. So I guess I love talking about time. I find it insanely fascinating that people are, you know, that like, you know, 500, 600 years ago, hours were like still fluid, you know?
Yeah. Like, oh, totally. Yeah. Totally.
18 hours compressed to 12, you know, and vice versa. Yeah.
Well, I mean, oh, awesome. Like fun, England fact too, is like, even when we did have mechanical clocks here, it wasn't until the railroad was brought in that time was standardized.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, it would be different over in Bristol than it would be in London, which I find fun.
And one of my favorite, favorite anecdotes about history is that when they did finally standardize the clocks and they brought in the trains and everything like that, the biggest complaint from people was that the trains actually left and arrived on time because they weren't used to having to get to places to look at it.
Right.
I love that. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. That may be apocryphal. I don't really care. I think it's neat.
So it's interesting, though, because, like, a lot of these time things that you see from medieval people, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you've got these monastic things, and you've got these ways of doing the day, right? But a lot of measurement stuff, and, like, so for with the calendar, a lot of it is all based on, like, Roman things.
Right.
And I was all like, oh, what does that mean? So I started digging around in, like, the Roman stuff for creating calendars, and, babe, it is wild. Okay. Right? So it's like, because the civil calendar, right, is the Roman calendar. Mm-hmm. And, like, the Roman calendar, as we sort of know it, kind of came into being in about, like, the first century BC.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, Julius Caesar brings this in.
Right.
And it takes the place of what had been before a 10-month lunar calendar, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the 10-month lunar calendar went March, April, May, June, Quinctilis, Sextilis, September, October, November, December. Okay. But then around 450 BC, they create January and February.
Ah.
Okay. And then they go, okay, well, January is going to be like the new March. So March used to be the beginning of the year, but then January became the beginning of the year. But then that's really funny because then the numbered months, Quinctilis and Sextilis, don't make sense anymore. Right, because they mean 5 or 6, and suddenly there's 7 and 8. And so they're like, okay, well, which is how you end up getting them named like after Julius Caesar and Caesar Augustus, right?
Yeah.
And at the same time, around before that, the divisions of the month used to be linked to lunar observations. And so that's why you'd have like ides and calends and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. That's about like what you look at the kind of the date. So they then adopt kind of like this fixed formula for how you're doing it. So it's not really about phases of the moon anymore. So for a little while there, you've got this like what they call a lunar solar calendar. So like the lunations, which is what you call like the phase of the moon, they're kind of like established. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of look at calculation in order to figure out what's going on. And so, like, the best bit of this is, like, how, in order to stay on track, they then figure out leap years, okay? Because, like, because at first, their year adds up to 355 days, okay?
Yeah.
So, in order to deal with this, every second year, they have February become 23 or 24 days. Okay, and then they add an extra month in. They add an extra month that's called a mensis intercalcaris, and that has 27 days. And then in order, if you just like every couple of years, you slap another month in there, then that keeps you vaguely in line with the solar year. And then like Julius Caesar was like, this shit's a fucking mess, right? Like this is a mess. Yeah. And like what's going on here? So the way he does standardize this, I'm very serious. He has 1 year that lasts 445 days. And then, I can't stop laughing. And then he, like, starts the new calendar on the 1st of January in, like, 450 BC, right?
Yeah.
And the near year is, like, 365.25 days, right? Mm-hmm. And the way that they do this is they alternate 30 days 1 month and 31 the next month, and they go on, off, except mm-hmm. for in February, which is 29 days, in which they sometimes add another day to, okay? But then, they weren't keeping good track of whenever they were, like, adding the extra
days.
Oh,
really?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Right? So they're, like, over-calculating it, and it's just, like, and then Augustus is, like, okay, well, that's it. We're not doing leap years for a while because we need to, like, get back on track, and, like, shit's too fucked up. And so, like, they make some, you know, technical adjustments. You add days in here and there. And that's how you get the Augustan calendar that we have now. So it's, like, you know, 31 days in June, in like, January and 28. Da-da-da. Like, that's kind of, like, where it comes wrong, right? Mm-hmm. But adding the extra day in February, like, the kind of, like, 28 to 29 after the Augustan calendar is a medieval invention. But hilariously, the way they think about it is that they're like, oh, you double the 24th of February. They're not like there's a 29th of February. There's like there's two February 24ths.
24 and 24A, like.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Oh, God.
So,
oh, man. Humanity's, like, humanity's ability to make anything way too fucking complicated is,
But it's like within that, you know, the average person doesn't pay that much attention to what's like going on, you know, day to day in terms of what the calendar is. They kind of pay more attention to the liturgical year. And like, so most Sundays will have a name. It'll be like, you know, oh, the first Sunday after Easter or like, you know, they all have like these differing names, right? And then like they spend a bunch of time in the medieval period, like trying to calculate how you're going to find Easter. Because Easter Sunday, you know, it's a movable feast. And so it's moving back and forth within, like, basically, if there's, like, a 35-day range.
Yeah.
Which is a lot when you think about it. And then apparently...
That is so... Yeah, so,
yeah, like, it's just, like...
So, the calculation of Easter is so fucking insane. Like,
yeah.
For 2,000, or, you know, 1,700 years or something like that, people have been like, well... You got 35 days here. Now let's look at the moon. Let's look at the... And it's just like, we could just memorialize it. Like, just memorialize it on a certain
day. I know, which is quite funny, right? Because it's like, you know, like you've got Sunday that moves around. And then like what are called the satellite holidays, which are off of those, which is like, you know, your Ash Wednesday and your Pentecost and, you know, things like that. But then we have fixed feasts too, because like Christmas is always the same day. You know, Epiphany is the same day. Right. All Saints the same day. So it's not like they can't do that. They just don't. And they're really into it. Like, you'll find all these like interesting calculations like all the time. They're just always paying attention to where Easter is going to be. And I find that really fun. But it's just such a different way of like where the attention goes, like what they care about.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, like, I think that it's just kind of interesting to see, like, what they think you need to emphasize and what they kind of think about time. So it's just, like, totally, totally different way of conceiving of time or, like, how the year works. But also, it's kind of, like, medieval people who are, like, came up with the formula that works to keep it on track. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone's always like, oh, well, the Romans are the ones who are so good with science and math. And I'm like, homie, they had a 455-day year because they couldn't fucking figure it out. Right? And I'm not like, don't get me wrong, no shade. I couldn't like be able to come up with that. I don't have the power.
Yeah.
But frankly, I'm not the one going around being all like, oh, the Romans are the be all end all and medieval people suck, when medieval people are the ones who are like straightening it out, you know?
I got to be completely honest with you. If you figure, like, the fact that they can figure out like anything about like the passage of time and the passage of like, you know, the stars, and then divide that up and figure out that, you know, the earth, figure out that there's like a 0.25 extra day, like that far in the past. I'm like, man, you like, that's fucking awesome. Like,
yeah, just people
we just figured like, yeah, we calculated how this star was moving. It's like, yeah, but still, that's wild to me. People just figure that shit out. That's neat. So, yeah.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com, and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
So measuring size. So
yeah.
I need to know about the feet thing.
Yeah.
As a unit of measurement. Was it really based on a king's foot size?
No, that's a myth.
God damn it.
I know. The thing is that this is like one of the oldest, like one of the oldest forms of measurement that we have. And it goes back to Sumeria. Right? So the first written account we have of like the foot as a measurement is from 2575 BC.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, which is, so it's like old as hell. Interestingly, sometimes a foot is about 12 inches. Sometimes it's like 10 inches. For a while, it was kind of like 11.75. But in general, what it's supposed to be is like the average person's foot size. So not necessarily a king or whatever. It's more like this should be kind of like a rough and ready thing that anybody can kind of like have.
Right.
So we know the Sumerians are using it. The one that we use that ends up being around 12, we think that maybe the Greeks adapted it from the Egyptians. And then the Romans had a slightly longer one. So the Greeks and Egyptians might have been working more on like the 10-inch foot. But the Romans kind of like have the longer one. And of course, medieval people then are just like, oh, well, if the Romans were doing it.
Oh, yeah.
That's
you
for us.
You gotta keep it.
Yeah, like... And that's where, you know, as we'll kind of see, a lot of the measurements that you have in the medieval period, they're just like Roman ones. Or if they aren't specifically Roman, they'll use Latin words to describe what they have as a particular form of measurement.
Right.
So, like, they are very interested in keeping these particular measurements alive. And that makes a lot of sense, right? Because if you kind of, like, understand them as being like, well, we're the inheritors of Rome... And the way that measurements work a lot of times is like, these are these kind of like building blocks of society. So it's like, how much is a loaf of bread supposed to weigh? How much do you get in a barrel of wine? Like what, how much can you pack into a ship? Stuff like that. So these are like really kind of innate things that it just matters to the day-to-day running of society, right? So obviously they're going to like cleave as much as they can to the Roman way of doing things.
Right, yeah. And I mean, it's one of those things that's so important that even in societies where they don't have written records, they, you know, we found archaeological evidence and other evidence to say that these people still had ways of, you know, tabulating things, like, you know, it may not have been written. Some places use like knots on cords. I believe that's in like ancient Peru or South America, you know. But so, you know, this is just something that people have figured out, you know, like, if you're going to have a society, if you're going to have people together doing these things, you can't just have one person being like, you know, this is 10 ounces of flour, and they drop, you know, like a 2-pound bag on, you know.
Because it
fucks everything up. Then, like, it undermines the basis of the system of government and everything like that. And it seems really weird to say that. But at the same time, if all of a sudden, you know, the state, you know, if you're in America, if the state over from you decides to change from the mile to the kilometer, or, you know, if you're in England and somebody, you know, vice versa, the nearby town, you're going to be like, what the fuck, you know, what the fuck? Like, what are you doing? Yeah. So basis of government is measuring things.
So, like, fun fact, my next door neighbor, shout out to a legend, Nikos, the cat's uncle.
Thanks, Nico.
He works for the Standards and Weights Commission of the EU. Yeah. He has seen the kilogram.
The actual
one? Yeah, there's an actual kilogram, and they like check it all the time because it's like because it's made out of like a particularized metal, so it is like within the range of possibility that it could like change over. So they have to like.
Oh, I figured it would be gold for some reason.
Yeah, I forget what he said that it's made out of, but it's like it's like this perfect cube that is a kilogram, and I don't know, for some reason I just think that's cool as hell.
That is cool. Like that they have the, I mean, like it, like, you know, the EU is a, you know, overall you know, not the best organization, but like the silly little things like that, like the, I mean, it's not exactly the same, but like the mace in England, fucking love the mace.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
I want America to have stupid, like, you have to hold the mace while you're talking, kind of like, because people in politics should be made to suffer.
I can't agree more.
Having grown up in evangelical Christianity, I grew up reading the King James version of the Bible, which means I get to read measurements that I did not fucking understand. What the fuck is a rod?
Okay, so a rod, annoyingly, is just a yard. Right. It comes from the Latin verga, which kind of like means twig or rod. But the thing is, it turns out that yard is an English word that meant rod. At the time is the thing. So interestingly, like, we just kind of like call it a yard now, but like for English people at the time, they're like, yeah, that's the same thing.
Yeah.
Like it would just be kind of like, it's like saying, you know, stick versus. Whatever, you know. So it comes from the Latin. It is a yard. We know what it is. We just don't say rod anymore.
We do say yard here all the time, especially for the ye olde American football. And actually soccer uses yards too a lot, you know.
Oh, okay.
Football to everyone else, because like the 18-yard box, the 6-yard box, which is the much smaller box in goal, the penalty spot is, you know, man, I'm going to sound like an idiot. I think it's 12 yards. It may be 10. My brain is going weird right now. I played soccer for a long time, so that's embarrassing. But what is a cubit?
A cubit.
Oh, sorry, you were going to say something.
Yeah, I was just going to say both the kinds of football that I follow, which is to say rugby union and Aussie league, Aussie rules football. Like, no, there's no yards. Although Aussie rules football is really confusing because you play it on cricket pitches, so there's like no standardized field.
Yeah.
It's just fucked. I love it.
Yeah, before we had a kid, me and my wife used to get drunk sometimes. We'd stay up late and ESPN would show like Aussie rules football. And like we would just watch it, and like it's just one of those things where you like, I pick out things, like I'd be like, oh yeah, that's like soccer. Oh yeah, that's like our football.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, that, and it's, but then like it's just Aussie eyes because like someone put it in a drum, spun the drum as fast as they could, and just pulled it all out. It's awesome. I'm not making fun.
Oh yeah,
it's
it rules. Awesome,
but
it
it's
rules.
Like watching it drunk is, I'm just like,
yeah. That's how God intended you to watch it.
Yeah,
like Gaelic football too, from which it derives, is also a good one and really fun. So
So. What is a cubit?
Okay, so a cubit is the distance of the average person's elbow to the tip of their middle finger. And this was standardized at about 18 inches.
Cool.
So it's one of those ones where it's just helpful. You can kind of eyeball it. You can just kind of go, I think that's about that for Keep It. But it does become standardized. It is 18 inches, but it's based on this particularized way of measuring, which is fun.
I think I've already spoiled it, but what a hogshead.
Yeah, hogshead.
And why is it called a hogshead?
Okay, so interestingly, hogsheads, we think, have come out of, like, it's sort of like a North Sea one. And there's, like, the Dutch version of it is called an okshoofd. And the Danish version is a okshoved. And in the Swedish, it's okshoved. We think that, like, all of those are more like oxhead, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, not hogshead. So we think English people just kind of, like, got the wrong end of the stick here. And they were like, hogshead, yeah, sure, fine. And it's used for measuring wine, beer, and ale. And it's usually about 79 gallons, which is particular.
I'm going to ask. So did they, like, if someone was like, hey, that hogshead is whatever, like, are they going in there, they're like, this is a gallon, boop, boop.
Yeah.
Like, is it?
Yeah, I think so. It's like, so basically, a lot of it will be that, like, you know, a barrel or whatever gets made one time, and they're like, okay, well, this is, like, the dimensions of an oxhead barrel, and then you make more oxhead barrels. And like, basically, here in England, that gets standardized by Parliament in 1423. So it's kind of like a late medieval standardization, but something that was definitely floating around. So, this is one of those kind of, like, North Sea connection kind of things.
Yeah.
And it really tells you a lot, actually, about how trade works, right?
Yeah.
In Northern Europe, because you're like, oh, yeah, okay, well, that makes sense, right?
Yeah, the English picked up and bastardized, and I don't mean that bad. They picked up and bastardized a word from, from the... the Scandinavians. That's really cool. So what is a furlong?
Okay.
I hope it has to do with fur.
Okay, so this is a good one. And because this gets into, which I'm going to introduce a few others that I like, of my favorite forms of measuring. So a furlong is based on the average length of a plowed furrow. So a furlong is basically like a foreshortening of furrow long, specifically in the open field system in England. So it's about the length of a 40 by 4 rod acre, which is about 660 modern feet. And now this is linked to the Roman measurement of a stadium, which is a unit of linear measurement that is about a 625 Roman pedes, which is like feet, right? Pedes. And so that's used in England for the furlong, and it's about equal to about an eighth of a mile, right? Like that, that's kind of like, so, I'm really into, these measurements that are like, oh, well, that's how long a furrow is. That's how long whatever is, because there's also this excellent one that is called a bovata. Okay. And this is great. So a bovata is the amount of land that is worked by one ox or team of oxen over a year. So, which is kind of like, a bovate is oftentimes like what a serf's holding is. So exactly what a bovada is going to depend based on what the quality of the soil is. So if you've got a really heavy soil, your bovada is going to be smaller because it's going to take longer for the oxen to get through it. So a bovada is about half of a vergate, or one eighth of another great term, which is a hide. Okay. And a vergate is usually a quarter of a hide, which is two bovates. But again, it varies quarter according to soil. And then there's another one, which is called a caricata, which comes from the Latin for cart. And later on, it kind of means like plow. And that's about the same thing as a hide. But it is considered to be the amount of land that's needed to support a peasant family for a year.
And then
you have another thing called a denariata. And that comes from the Latin denarius, which kind of like means penny. And that's considered to be about a penny worth of land. And so that's a reference to like the yearly rental of like goods or land. And they'll be like, oh, yeah, well, okay, well, that's a denariata. Like, you'll eye it up and be like, it must cost about that much. So there's all these forms of measurement that are like, well, that all depends. Like, how sturdy is your ox, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, length is this kind of, like, variable thing, because when they're really kind of thinking about land, you know, it isn't the length of it that actually matters. What matters is the motion of the plow, you know? It's all about how many people can it support? How much work is it going to take to support them? That's, you know, the way that you need to kind of think about length there.
Yeah, that's awesome. So I guess one other thing about, you know, size and length measurements is, so like, how did they measure very long distances or like very large objects? Would their understanding of the distance from, you know, like, I don't know, Paris to Barcelona or something like that be accurate to ours, or was it just more of like a general thing?
So annoyingly, it really depends. A lot of the time when they talk about long journeys, they talk about it in the length of time it usually takes to complete.
Yeah.
So they'll be like, it takes this long. But if it's on stuff like Roman roads, oftentimes they know.
Huh. Okay.
Because they'll kind of like have an understanding of this. And it's because there's this this Roman form of measurement, which is called a millia passum, which is like 1,000 paces, mm-hmm. which is what makes a Roman mile. And so that's kind of like between 5,000 and 660 feet. And it's like, so, and that's either like, if you are saying that there are 1,000 or 1,500 paces that are involved in it. And so they will have a kind of understanding of what a mile is in terms of that, like, if, because they'll know like, oh, well, this Roman road is this long. And so they'll be like, oh yeah, well, it's kind of like this far along. And they do put down stuff like mile markers.
Right.
And things like that in between larger cities and things. So they do kind of have a look at those things. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cool. So yeah. So the last thing today, I guess, was just, you know, holdovers. We still use things like feet and acres and yards, you know, so what other holdovers did they have in the Middle Ages? I assume based on what we said that a lot of it's based on, you know, old Roman measurements.
And so I've just picked out some of my favorite other Roman ones. So there's one that is called which they call a palm. This comes from passus or pace or palma in Latin. And it is the length of a hand's breadth minus the thumb. And it standardizes out to about 3 inches.
Huh.
And I think that one's a really cool one because, again, like, I'm into the ones where it's just like, yeah, like where you can eyeball it, like sort of put your hand up.
Yeah.
There it is. But then there's some kind of some arbitrary units within that that the medieval English have, which are quite funny. So, all right. Do you know how the English calculate what an inch is?
I do not.
Fun. Okay. An inch is 3 medium-sized barley corns placed end-to-end. Which I absolutely love. Because I'm like, how are we defining a medium-sized barley corn? Right? It's like, go get your barley corns. Like,
everybody knows the standard... the standard barley corn measure.
I know, right? And they're just like, oh yeah, like break out the barley corn. Like we got to figure out if this is an inch or not. So that's quite fun. But you know, as we say, we've got these holdovers, which are like feet and square yards or square perches. And this is interesting, right? So this is all a way of kind of like getting me into saying what some of the conversions are, which is fun. Okay. Cause I was like, oh yeah, square feet. We know what that is. Square yards. We get what it is. What the fuck is a perch, right? So a perch, one perch, is 30 1/4 square yards, which is really specific. Like, I like how they get that quarter in there. And then there are 40 perches to the rood. And then 4 roods makes an acre. Okay. And we know what an acre is. And then it's 640 acres to 1 square mile.
Yay!
So we're like, so the thing is, we understand what a square mile is, like we understand what a yard is and all this stuff, but there's all these like fun bits in between that we're like, what the fuck's a rood, you know? And it's like, oh, rood, that's 40 perches.
Oh yeah, everybody knows a perch.
Great, you know. And so, and I just find that really fun how there's kind of like all these things in between that we just don't really know about. And then I guess I just want to do like a quick shout out, because it's like, in terms of when I was when I was researching all this, I was like, oh, what about like cooking measurements and stuff like that? How do they do things like that?
Mm-hmm.
And then I went and read up on a bunch of things, and it turns out that like medieval recipes usually don't have amounts of anything. And the way that like medieval recipes work is they tell you what's in things, and they tell you like the order of things that you put in a dish, but it never kind of tells you how to do them. And there's a kind of a couple reasons for this. It's like sometimes we think that when recipes are written down, it's kind of like just to remind the head cook like what the order is, right? Mm-hmm. Or like what they're supposed to be doing. And sometimes it'll be just like for whatever their head of the household is, right? So that they can kind of know if they, you know, if the cook dies or they get a new cook, they can be like, well, this is the thing that I want, right?
Right.
So it's also quite interesting because then within it, we don't have a whole lot of recipes. Like we've got these ones, but what the ones that we have, it means that like these are never cookbooks that got used by anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that they aren't because they're not like covered in food and stuff. But then, like, there's this one cookbook that's written by, like, the most famous 14th century French chef. They existed. And his name was Guillaume Thiel. And he writes this cookbook called Viandier. And he talks about how, like, a lot of times he doesn't give instructions in the books because he says, like, and this is a quote, everyone knows how to do them. As for tripe, which I've not put in my recipe book, it's common knowledge how it's prepared. Right. So he's like, I'm not going to tell you how to like do all this. So we're missing all of these like recipes or like measurements for things. Cause it's like, well, everybody knows what that is. Right. And so what ends up in these cookbooks are only the stuff that like the most complex, most sophisticated, crazy ass dishes that mm-hmm. like only a master chef who's got like a whole team of people working underneath him could pull off. Mm-hmm. Right. This ends up changing kind of like into the 15th century. And so like the later a recipe is, the more details it'll have.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's kind of when things start to standardize. But from a medieval way of thinking, a recipe never has measurements and it's just not something that they think about. So I just thought that was quite fun, right?
That's awesome. Man, I can only imagine how either completely unseasoned or insanely overseasoned everything must
be. Right, have been. Yeah, just like...
Like, you got one guy who's like, yeah, one sprig of parsley. And then you've got another guy who's like, well, I mean, it's said to add mint.
He's yeah, just like, oh, totally,
handfuls.
Totally.
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, you know, I think that's about going to do it for us today. Thank you so much for listening. Eleanor, where can the good people find your work?
Like for now, you can check me out on Twitter at @goingmedieval. I started a Mastodon account. I don't know what I'm doing with it. I'll bring that up. This great prep, Eleanor. Good job. So I'm at Dr. Eleanor Yonaga at mastodon.world. I don't know what I'm doing over there. I might never use it, but I just felt like I needed a lifeboat. So there's stuff there. My blog, as ever, is going-medieval.com. And you can pre-order my next book, The Once and Future Sex. Please and thank you.
Yes, and my name is Luke. You can find me at LukeIsAmazing on Twitter. I also have a Mastodon, but I don't remember what it is because I don't ever go over there. But yeah, I don't know. If I need a lifeboat, I guess I'll figure out something else. you can also find my old show about Star Wars. It's called A People's History of the Old Republic. You can find it wherever you are listening to this right now. But that's going to do it for us today. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.